Welcome to Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we explore life's toughest issues along with the art, science, and stories of resilience. Please be advised that our guests share their raw stories of addiction, abuse, crime, and tragedy, along with tips to survive and thrive. And now, here is our host, Dr. Randall Bell.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Post-Traumatic Thriving. I am Dr. Randall Bell, Tanya Brown.
Hey, Randy.
And hi to our guest, Wes Geer.
Hi. Hello.
Hello. Well, I'm excited. I'm a guitar freak.
You are?
Probably not on your level, but we'll certainly get a chance to talk about guitars. But just welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Thanks for doing stuff like this.
Yeah. Well, and thanks for sharing your story because, you know, on this podcast, and this is Season 2, our very first episode, and we're so happy to have Wes here, you know, to kind of kick things off for a new season. But, you know, what we do is we talk about stuff that people don't normally talk about because that's been shown through all kinds of clinical studies to be very healthy, a very, you know, great way to heal. So, you know, you're obviously a big rock star. I don't think you need a huge interdiction.
Big is subjective.
But well,
I'm glad you think so.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I know Korn has played for huge venues.
That's true.
And you've toured like dozens of countries.
Yes, over 60. Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa. I thought it was like 40, but.
Well, you know.
I went to Dana Hills High School. Man, I didn't even know there were 60 countries.
Yes.
I missed that day. I was surfing.
Yeah. I never learned to like name every state and capital thing either. So, but I think we're up to 42 states or something.
Awesome.
Like now. Yeah.
Awesome. Oh, wow.
What's so great about this podcast, Wes, is that, you know, Randy and I, we've done so many interviews, and I'm sure you have too, where they keep you there for 6, 7, 8 hours, and then they use like 30 seconds of those 6 to 8 hours. And the whole purpose of this podcast is like, we want to know, like, what was life before, what happened, and, you know, what made you do, or, you know, how'd you become what you are today? And so many people walk out. Actually, I think every guest has walked out of this podcast going, this is like the longest podcast I've ever done, but it's been the most effective and the most rewarding.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here and be a part of that. And I noticed that you have an IV trailer out back, and I can get some IV fluids when I get tired.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
So there's a whole medical tent out here for this.
Whatever you need, man.
B12, please. Yeah. Thanks.
Nice cocktail.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing you haven't always been a rock star. You know, tell us, let's kick it off from ground zero. Where were you born and what was life like as a kid?
I'm from the Pleiadian galaxy.
Oh,
I know you're probably not ready to hear that. And most of you are not. I am. No.
It sounds like Kiss.
I actually do think that aliens probably put us humans here on the planet Earth. You think I'm crazy now? Give it a few years. You'll be more receptive to this concept. I was born in Fullerton, St. Jude Hospital, where my father was a doctor. And grew up in Fullerton until I was 5. Well, here's the crazy part. Now, I'm single. And so as I date, I'm like, okay, she has a kid, something to take in consideration. Well, in that kind of realm, my dad had 5 kids. My mom had 2 kids from previous marriages. They met. My dad enjoyed dating his nurses. Mom was a nurse there. And they decided to get married. And so they had 5 and 2. I think that's 9. And jokes, 7. And then they decided to have me. Actually, I don't know if they decided. But I'm here.
There you are.
So they had me. So that's how it started. And my parents divorced at 5. And it's interesting. It's cool to talk about this stuff because, you know, what we learn is throughout time, stories change meaning. And we might go back to an old story or something that happened in our life. And then we go, oh, we see it with a new light. But then what you realize when you do this a while, that story will change again and again and again and again as we evolve and see it from different angles. But, you know, if I was younger and you said, yeah, your parents divorced, I would say, yeah, no big deal. You know, Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd like to see my dad. Yeah, it's cool. And then the more I went on in life, and I know we're going to save this stuff till later, I realized how much it did impact me. But in the essence of staying on the timeline, I do remember seeing my mom and dad fight. And, you know, I'm 5 years old, and it really hit me. Like, I don't like, you know, I love you, you know. And of course, I'm only five, so I don't know so well what was going on. But yeah, it was a bum out. And then I went with my mom, and we bailed back east where she was from, and then moved in with my grandparents. And that's kind of where the part of the musical story starts. She was a nurse and went back to nursing school, and we're living with my grandparents. And of course she had her two kids and me for three of us. And I remember, you know, and by the way, my mom probably won't ever hear this, but this stuff's, she's a really sweet lady, and this stuff's hard for her to hear, you know what I mean? Cause she really tried to do her best. But the conversation we have to have is like, it doesn't mean that she wasn't awesome. And what we learn is that parents who are awesome screw up their kids by being awesome. Parents can't not screw up their children. It's just a reality. And it doesn't mean that we're blaming them or playing victim. What it means is that it caused stuff in us, it challenges in us that were from certain behavioral patterns, even if they were good ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, while my mom is going back to nursing school to earn and be the badass mom raising three kids on her own, we got our own place that we rented, and then my grandma died. And so grandpa came to move in with us, and I just remember being home alone a lot, and which was cool. But also, I remember it, the bus stop was right out at the bottom of our driveway. So that worked out, but I would make myself cream of wheat. I had this little thing you plug in the wall, and it looked almost like an element on an electric stove, but coiled up, and you'd put it in a cup of water and it would boil it. And so then I'd make my cream of wheat with like 8 pounds of brown sugar and half and half in it. And I was happy, and I got myself on the bus, and then I would come home, and at the end of our street was a cul-de-sac they never finished building, and it was just empty forest. And I would just go out and screw around in the forest. And I have lots of cool recollections. But one thing I always remember is when my grandfather would come home, he'd let our dog out, and I'd be a mile deep in the forest, and I'd hear jingle, jingle, jingle. Here comes my dog, Jasmine, coming to find me. And that was cool. So it was Jasmine and I, young guy playing in the forest. But, you know, I can't say I can attach any sort of emotion to that period, but I'm sure, you know, if you could go in my mind, there's probably some loneliness or whatever, or self-reliance. There's probably stuff on all sides of the spectrum of what it was like for me to live like that. You know, I don't, this day and age, you couldn't do that. You couldn't tell your kid at 5, 6, 7 years old, get your kid to school on it.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if CPS would come after you, but certainly people would be scared to do it in this day and age.
For sure.
Yeah. No kidding. Was this all in Fullerton?
No. So that when my parents divorced, mom and I went back east to reconnect with her family.
Yeah.
So we were in Massachusetts in a suburb, in Norwell. We started in Hingham, then we were in Norwell, and my uncle lived out there. And so she, you know, like many single female parents, especially, go back home for support, you know?
Right. Sure. Yeah. So it sounds like it was an okay, you know, childhood. I mean, your dad's a doctor, your mom's a nurse, you love them both. And, you know, divorce happens. I get it. It sounds like you kind of got it, but you're making things work as a kid.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, we'll get into it later. The divorce really screwed me up on subtle levels underneath that I had to uncover later.
Yeah.
And we could talk about that later, but, but by all outward appearances, it was cool. But then I would fly to see my dad for weeks at a time in California as they shared me. And it was them putting me on a plane by myself at 6 years old.
Oh, with a little badge.
I don't even know if I got a badge. You know what? I won't divulge this. This is too much, but it was a little hairy. Like, I just remember, I'm on a plane. Cool. Dad picks me up. But I heard some stories later in life. It's like, you guys did that? That's pretty scratchy. I remember leaving, you know, Boston in a snowstorm on a plane, and will the plane take off or not? There was some stuff like that. And then when we got over to, you know, dad's part of town. He was living in Tustin at the time. Then started some other stuff with, you know, some sexual abuse that happened, which I want to be very delicate how I name that, because I don't want to incriminate anybody. But, you know, again, that was stuff that I didn't know if it was wrong or right. Like, you know what I mean? You don't know. And,
right.
And it's people close to you and or that you know that you feel close to anyhow. And again, I didn't even think about that for years until later when I got into recovery, you know. And it's interesting, too, when I think about this, because I have some drama with people like from my first band days and stuff. And it's really just about, I get it, it's the top level drama, like, will they forgive me? Will we forgive each other for the areas we screwed up in? But it's like, man, I wish I could get underneath that and tell you that it's not what you thought. It was me being traumatized at a young age, thereby acting out when I'm older. So you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, completely. For
sure. Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting to get in and unravel that stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, on the outside, if you ask me, especially as an early teenager about my life, I'd be like, yeah, cool. My parents, you know, Christmases were good. The presents were good. But stuff was happening under the surface, should I say, that was tough. So then, let me see here. So we're in Massachusetts now, and then my mom reconnected with her high school sweetheart, who was now a police officer in Fountain Valley, California. So they were courting each other long distance, and I'm talking this has to be like late 70s, early 80s. And eventually decided to go for it. And we moved to Fountain Valley, California.
Oh,
moved in with stepdad, a guy I had never met. So that's kind of awkward. And again, at the time, I didn't know. It's so weird when you're young because you don't know what you're feeling.
Right.
It's just, and I'm actually working on a book, and one of the chapters, another chapter is Your Normal, meaning Y-O-U-R, normal. Because whatever you experience is your normal.
Right.
Yeah.
That's all you know.
Exactly.
Especially when you're younger and you have nothing to compare it to. So my normal life was moving from Massachusetts to go. And again, mom has a right to pursue love and all this. But now I'm in the fourth grade, I believe, and new in school again. That's a big part of my story, is going to a lot of schools. And I don't know if I was insecure already, but certainly going to new school, I'm insecure. I think it was probably a little of both. So it was constantly like, and I didn't understand the simple concept of like, just be nice and you'll make friends. I thought you had to be extra. I thought you had to be special. Like, you know, and I had all these weird behaviors. I mean, I'll tell you one.
Yeah.
This is really embarrassing. When I was in Massachusetts and the new guy in first or second grade, I would walk to school. And maybe I'm like narcissistic or delusional. Also, kids have imagination, but I remember I'm like, oh, you know, these kids are going to see me. I don't have any friends type scenario. And I had this long jacket, and I thought, okay, well, if I run real fast and like put my hands on my hips, like Superman, you know, like he does when he's standing on the mountain and the cape flies, they'll see me fly and they'll look like a cape and they'll be like, that guy is cool. I remember thinking that, and then they'll like me. Right. I felt like I had to do something and be extra to be liked. And that actually channels back to some dad issues I have later that I didn't know. But that was like how it was. Like, what do I got to do to get the world to accept me and love me? And so, yeah, when we were in, now I'm jumping back to Fountain Valley, when my mom connected with my stepfather, what would become my stepfather. I remember going to school and having plaid pants on, because in Massachusetts, they're still rocking the Bobby Brady plaid pants. Not so much in California.
Right?
And so they'd be like, hey, nice Brady Bunch plaid pants, you know? And you know, when you're a kid, you're just like, I just want you to like me. And then you hear that, that's reaffirming the like, oh man, I got to get shit right,
right,
or else they're not going to accept me and like me. And that's a big part of my whole story. Like that, and that went all the way into touring days, not knowing it, right? Because I think most humans are so unconscious to the subconscious wirings we have in our brain and how we're wired, you know, because what do you have to compare it against? Like when you go into a situation, your brain's like, doot, 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 A plus B is 47 B, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And then I might go in the same situation you do, and I'm going to have a total different, whatever it is, reaction or version of it or anyhow. So, that got us to about fourth grade.
Yeah. Well, I got to ask, during this time frame, were you aware of your musical gifts at all, or was that not a thing yet?
So my grandfather, my mom's side, was famous for playing the carillon. The carillon is basically the bell towers. And probably people listening go, oh, I've heard bell towers, but you really probably haven't, because most of them have either a recording of a bell or they have five bells to do the one melody they do at noon or whatever. These are bell towers that were built, you know, many, many years ago. And they, each note of the piano is a bell. So the little notes are like bells like this, and the big note, the low notes are giant, like 2-ton bells. And so he would take classical pieces and transcribe them onto, or, you know, whatever, transpose them onto the carillon. But the carillon had kind of like something you would see on a sailing boat where you tie a rope on, like a big wood lever. Mm-hmm. Those were the keys. So you're like,
right.
So if he's playing something, he's like really having to push, especially if it's a chord, you got to get a few of those things going at once. And so he was well known for doing that. He was the music director at our local church in Cohasset. So this is, you know, this is a classically trained guy who can handle the choir and, you know, whatever. I can't remember all the instruments playing, but like, you know, not like us rock people were like, bam, 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 that's not what I know. You know, like this is a guy who, hey, you're a little flat on that, you know, third harmony when you go up in here, when the baritone drops in, you gotta legato that part, you know, and that's who he was.
It was in his DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. In my DNA. And I was exposed to it. And it's kind of interesting too, because when you're a kid, a lot of the stuff you are exposed to that's normal is boring. Right. So like if you grew up on a farm, oh, this farm is so boring. But then you realize, wow, growing up on a farm is kind of cool.
Kind of cool.
So yeah, the classical music, blah, blah, blah. You know, it wasn't that I didn't like it. But then what I remember is that my brother played, and you'll know this, Smoke on the Water on his acoustic.
Yeah.
Bam, 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 bam. It has a flat five in there, which you don't hear much in a classical music. It's a bluesy tone that kind of has that rock and roll edge to it. And it's also played in it's a fourth. The chords are actually fourths, so they're very like sharp and grinding for being so simple. That caught my ear. I was like, I remember that. And it's kind of funny that at 6 years old, I was like, what is that?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
It's music, but not like anything I've been used to hearing, you know?
Yeah.
And so when we fast forward, when I get out to California, and you know, we're in Fountain Valley, we had a little condo. My stepbrother got dropped off by his mom to us out of nowhere. So it went from 2 to 3, I guess, unexpectedly, as the story goes. He and I didn't get along well in those early days. I mean, we grew to be tighter, but it was a lot of, you know,
yeah.
Yeah.
Like dogs.
Siblings.
Yeah, exactly. like dogs. but anyhow, so then we moved from Fountain Valley. We went into Garden Grove, and that's where I picked up the guitar. And that's when I got my first record. It was actually my stepbrother. I said I wanted Iron Maiden because Iron Maiden had these really grotesque monster guy called Eddie on the front, and it looked cool. And they didn't have Iron Maiden, so he got me Van Halen, which was cool because Van Halen was a monster guitar player at the time, and he did so many otherworldly sounds with his guitar that most people had never done before, just sound effects and just really groundbreaking innovations. And he also was one of the most famous for doing what they call hammer-ons, which you know, which are very legato sounding, meaning very smooth. They don't have the percussiveness of the pick, which is like K-k-k-k. My grandfather, by the way, when I would play for him, he'd be like, cool. You know, I'm obviously probably horrible at the time. He's like, cool, but can you not, like, what's that pick sound, you know, because when you play with distortion on an electric, we get used to it as rock players, but there is kind of a ugly timbre of that every time you hit a note. Anyhow, just a point of reference, but Eddie Van Halen would play these hammer-ons where you're tapping with your finger and not picking, and then you're doing essentially arpeggios, and they're very like church cathedral sounding. And he, and what Eddie did with them, and other players like Randy Rhodes who did them, they all did them around kind of complex classical melodies and chord progressions.
So did you have any classical training at all, or is it just all you went right to rock?
Yeah, so That's what made me want to play. And I think a lot of it was like, oh, now I'm hearing the rock thing, but I'm also hearing like this like otherworldly sound that was really making me go, I want to play that. And so I just started learning people's stuff. Uh-huh. And back in that time, there was a lot of magazines out, you know, hard copy magazines, and I would get them and read about what people were doing. They'd usually throw in like a scale. And then so like, for example, then I got into Yngwie Malmsteen. That's a little down the road, but he was playing like ripping fast classical runs like a violin would. Mm-hmm. That aside from Al Di Meola, which is an acoustic guy, not as many people knew, Yngwie in the realm of rock was heralded as like the guy that did this. And he was at that time really the only one doing that kind of lightning fast, which took me back to Paganini and Bach and all this kind of these kind of runs. But my point is, he was very classical in his melodies and stuff like that. Right. And so I would just read like, oh, he's using harmonic minor in the Phrygian right here. And oh, that sound, I love that. It's a diminished seven arpeggio. And then I would just learn it and then go, that's that. And that's how I kind of taught myself theory.
So did you take lessons? Or, and by the way, how old were you when you picked up the guitar and really got serious about it?
So I got the guitar as probably 14, I say, in Garden Grove, early, just about to go into high school.
Okay.
Yeah. And then so, well, one part of that story is we had been in Garden Grove now for, I'm kind of jumping around, but you know what? You'll just have to try to do your best if you're listening.
I was born in Garden Grove, by the way.
You were?
Yeah.
All right.
Palm Harbor.
We're vibing on Garden right. Grove and Fountain Valley, Fullerton.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Awesome. So just to like give you the lineage update. So mom meets stepdad. We go to Fountain Valley. We're in a condo. Then we decide to move to Garden Grove. They buy a house. Whoopee who. And then I was there for like 6 years probably or so. So I got a couple years of elementary school, couple years of junior high school, and then started high school. So I finally had some roots.
Yeah.
And that's when I started playing guitar, started getting into rock music when you're old enough to start picking, I like this or whatever, you know. And then my parents were like, we're going to move. We're going to move to El Toro. And then Garden Grove was kind of going downhill. And I mean, there was like some gnarly shit that was happening. But we decided to move to El Toro, which is like Lake Forest, Mission Viejo is a nice area at the time. Sure. Is newer there. And, okay, cool. But I remember being really depressed. Like I even wrote a letter to God, which is so weird about, not intentionally, but I was just like, oh man, I got my best buddy, Chris. We have our little band. Right, it wasn't a band. We've like found a Mickey Mouse drum set in the trash that was like for toddlers. We're like, hey, drum set. And we were trying to play. We didn't know how to play, but I was sad. It really hit me. And then so when we moved to El Toro, that was the first time I started smoking weed. And when I did my timeline of like they had me do when I was in rehab, it showed me where like when traumatic things would happen, whatever my using would go up and up and up.
Oh, I get it.
But
so yeah. you moved to Lake Forest. Now it's called Lake Forest. Now it's El Toro.
El Toro.
You moved there when you were about what, like 15 or?
Yeah.
Or still 14?
Yeah, 15? Yeah. I was probably freshman or I think it was a sophomore. So 14, 15. Yeah, something like that. But I was also, my birthday's in October, so I was a little younger than everybody else. So yeah, that's when I started playing guitar. And then when we got into school at El Toro High School, where I went, I'm back to the insecure. I'm the new guy, and I now smoke weed. So yeah. I would just connect with the stoners. It was an easy way to make friends. Oh, smoke weed. Yay, cool. Now we're buddies. And then I would go home and smoke weed all day and play guitar.
Okay.
Like all day. I was obsessed. It was my happy place, you know, and school bored the shit out of me. I never did homework. Fun story is every night I would go to my locker and go, okay, I got, you know, this homework and geometry. And I would grab every book I needed for the homework. And I never once would do it. But I couldn't leave without the proper books. And I was cognizant of that. But that's what I did. I would just play guitar. And somehow, you know, I did make it through high school.
And El Toro is a big high school. I mean, it's not like a little.
Did you go to El Toro High?
El Toro High. And so in the parking lot, the student parking lot, we would all smoke cigarettes and smoke weed out there. And because they had what they called the narcs, which were women.
Yeah.
There was a couple of women and they were really lax. Like, so if they came up, I can't remember her name, Miss Consitis. I think that's her name. Anyhow, I'd be smoking and I'd put the cigarette in my back pocket, hanging out, right? And what's up? What are you doing, Wes? Oh, nothing, just hang out. Okay, cool, you're good. Okay, bye, Miss Consignas. And I'd be like, boom, like they weren't trying. It was all, I don't know what was going on over there. I would buy weed in the parking lot, smoke it. And then during breaks, everybody would go into the men's bathroom. I don't know what was going on in the girls. But because the narcs, there's two of them were women, we knew they couldn't come in. We'd all smoke in there. And so one day I had this great idea. Well, I'm going to smoke some weed in here. I bought a couple joints at school. I was like, this is a perfect cover. Smoke my weed. And then right as I'm coming out, the principal comes in, which was weird. You didn't ever see him much. And they took us down the office. I remember having half a joint and the whole joint in my wallet and walking by a trash can. I could probably throw it in. Oh, damn it. I should have probably thrown it. And they searched me and found the weed. And then stepdad, who's like a cop, tend to be intense individuals, who also was, I think at the time, running the narcotics division of Fountain Valley Police Department, was not very happy.
Yeah.
And we fought that tooth and nail, but I ended up getting kicked out of that school. And so then I went... And now I'm smoking weed, so my mom's extra annoying. Even though she wasn't, it was me. Like, I'm changing internally, right. And I'm just like, don't tell me what to do. I want to grow my hair and rock and roll, and this cop doesn't let me turn my amp up loud. Fuck this, you know? And she's like, do you think you should go live with your dad? I was like, yeah, I should. He'll let me. I'm thinking he'll let me grow my hair. My mom and I have spoke about this, too, and she's like, that, you know, I hope you don't feel unwanted. And it's like, no, I wanted to go just so I could grow my hair. And play my guitar love. Mm-hmm. That's how selfish of a little kid. I was like, I knew it'd be sad to leave my mom, but I was like, must live the rock and roll dream.
You were 15, right? I mean, my God.
At this point, are you dreaming of being a rock star?
Yes. So that's a good question, because while I was in El Toro, like all the walls of my room were like Motley Crue, Iron Maiden. I would take the magazines and cut out the pictures and put up my favorite pictures.
Right.
My parents let me do that. That was cool. They didn't let me wear rock shirts though. Like, I had a Grim Reaper shirt and they're like, what is that? You can't wear that. So I would leave the house, carry my Grim Reaper shirt in my backpack or whatever, and then swap out shirts. And then sometimes if my parents came to school, they'd be like, you're swapping shirts. Huh? I gotta do what I gotta do. But, the thing is, the answer to your question is I had it in me. Like, I remember I had a friend that was like, you don't think you can make it. That's what we used to call it back in the day. You don't think you can make it. And I'd turn on the radio and say, I'm pretty sure I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, that was my point of reference. Here's what you do. I just have to do that.
Yeah.
And it was unwavering. I was not going to relent, you know? And so it's funny because my mom was cool enough to say something to the effect of like, you know, I thought about why you have all these rock bands in there. And it's like, you know what? It's kind of like a vision board for mm-hmm. you. That's what it mm-hmm. is. You know?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's
where my brain went.
Yeah. And that's what it was. And it's not like that for all people. Mm-hmm. Some people just want to put Katy Perry on the wall.
So do a quick rundown. Where I was a Zeppelin guy. And I had the big giant posters of Zeppelin, and I saw Deep Purple at the Shrine and, cool. you know, and, saw Zeppelin at the Forum, you know, so it was, and so run through who were kind of your idols at that stage of your life.
You guys, hang on. You guys are funny, because I'm kind of sitting back listening to this rock story when you guys are talking about Zeppelin and Kiss and Iron Maiden and all that. You know who was on my wall? Michael Jackson.
King of Pop.
I'm serious.
That's another episode.
Literally. Like, I would go to school with my red leather jacket and my silver sequins gloves.
Yeah. You had a glove?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And you admitted that?
Yes, I'm admitting it now.
We're recording, you know.
So I'm listening to this and I'm just going, oh, God. No, he was amazing back in the day.
Okay,
right?
Well, that's awesome.
The King of Pop.
This
yeah.
is funny.
Yeah. Super talented. And
my red.
And Eddie Van Halen played on his song Beat It, because Eddie Van Halen was the man at the time, and he did a guitar solo.
God bless him.
Yeah.
And so, it was like Iron Maiden and Van Halen got me into it. I didn't like Zeppelin at first. Like, it didn't hit me. I remember listening to Zeppelin 4, and it gave me a headache.
Oh, wow.
That's what I said to myself. It was a little too... You know, that kind of blues, shrill, the tones.
There's a lot of blues, yeah.
It didn't land for me at first. I was into, you know, but you know, what's interesting is first records I liked was like B-52s when they did like Rock Lobster and all that. I love that twang.
Great band.
I liked the Dead Kennedys. I liked, I loved the twangy, evil sounding guitar. And it, that you can hear in my playing in head PE a lot. But Iron Maiden and Van Halen. And then I was really into Motley Crue.
They were down in Manhattan Beach, I think. That's where they, if I remember right.
I just know them from as a Hollywood band, but it was definitely Motley Crue and Iron Maiden were my favorites. And then, but I was really into anything that had a guitar. I was just listening to the guitar player. So I love Randy Rhoads a lot. And then the Scorpions album was huge at that time. Love It for Sting, which is, we're going to talk guitar show. Matthias Jobs, if I'm saying his name right, super underrated guitar player. That guy's leads are just incredible. His tone's incredible. And so they were a great band I liked a lot back then. That was probably a lot of them. I liked Agent Orange, and I'm trying to think what. Oh, I loved Oingo Boingo.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, back
so then. There's a little bit of the 80s punk.
Well, he's classic, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, New Wave is more probably
Yeah, I liked a lot. And what was interesting for me, and Judas Priest was a big one. And you know, I got into Rainbow and all that stuff, but what's interesting for me is back then it was very, when you're in school, you were like either a rocker or a jock. And then there was like some punks, but whatever. And there was like New Romantic was a thing. So that was like Simple Minds and, you know, I don't know what other Wham and stuff like that. And, New Order and all that kind of stuff. And those guys are a little more flamboyant.
What's striking me is that your range of interests is pretty broad. Yeah. I mean, it's way more than the typical high school kid who has like,
that was my chair, by the way.
we'll get to that. I mean, like, you know, you had three bands and that was it. You're all over the place.
So, what I was going to say is that at that age, you kind of had to pick your channel. And I had like a tail and then my hair was like kind of longish in part of the middle, which was like a rocker. But then I wore Izod, which is like a preppy. And so I was like all over. So I kind of didn't.
Like mullet, tail, Izod.
I didn't really fit in, which now sounds really cool. I'm like, hey, I'm pretty cool, but I was kind of all over the place. Yeah. But, and that's what I like musically. I like a little bit of all of it. You know?
So cool. Coming, you know, kind of back to your story with the parents getting divorced and moving around and switching schools and feeling like maybe, you know, you're not fitting in the way you want to. It sounds like you kind of landed on a spot that was comfortable for you with the weed and the rock and the music and getting more and more into music. And I mean, at what age did you say, would you say that you were like, hey, I really connect, you know, this is like maybe what I want to do.
I think without realizing, cause I was so young, what I want to do, what that statement means. I think I wanted that from 15 or 16 or 17 is what I wanted to do.
Wow.
And so I had all these crappy bands, you know, garage bands, no singer. And we would play parties, and it was interesting at El Toro High School too, because they'd be like, hey, Chris Lilly, that was his name too. He's at the party up the street and he's got a guitar. And I would grab my amp and my guitar and we'd be like, have a shred off. And my friends would be like, oh, you blew him away, man. And so it's like this weird competitive thing. And, whether I did or didn't. And yeah. So, and then, like I said, I got kicked out of high school for smoking weed, moved in with my dad. Cause that was kind of like, I wanted to have more freedom to do music. And then I got kicked out of school up there and kicked out. I mean, I just kept getting kicked out of schools, but I kept doing music and trying to do bands as much as I could. And then finally, when I was 18, around that time, I started doing a lot of cocaine because one of my best friends was a few years older. He had a truck and he loved cocaine. Mm. I didn't really like it, but if I got drunk, for sure I was going to help him do his cocaine, because what a good friend, that's what we do, you know? And so at this time I met this guy, Brian Nussel, who was this prodigy bass player. This guy could play anything by Rush and Steve Harris, Iron Maiden, and sing and play and just talk to you while he's shredding. Like, hey, what's up? How's it going, man? I was like, how do you do that?
Wow. Right.
When I sing and play, I have to like talk. When I play and try to talk, I have to talk in the rhythm of what I'm playing. So how are you? So nice to see you. You know what I mean? And he can, how he did that, I don't know how. But anyhow, even to this day, like on stage, like my pedal board is shorting out. I don't know how these people do it. Anyhow, so
funny.
So I had all these crappy bands. So the reason I'm trying in the cocaine thing is because my dad, I'm living with the doctor. I turned 18. I'm like, well, I don't have to do curfew anymore. I just decided that. And I just stopped coming home and I just would do whatever I want. And he kicked me out because he's like, I don't know if I'm going to get the call that you're dead or not. You know, by this time.
When he kicked you out, what does that mean? You went back to your mom or what?
No, I slept in my car.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was one day Bob came to give me, that's my Coke friend with the truck. He came to give me a ride to school and there was some remnants of cocaine on a mirror. And I was like, oh, hey. And I was doing that at like 7 a.m. Oh, I wasn't doing Coke, but I did do that. And my stepmom saw it. So they brought in both sets of parents and they're like, what is going on? And I remembered, this was my, God bless them. They tried. This was my stepdad, the cop in the room. And I was like, you guys, I'm a musician and I smoke weed and it helps me. Now check this out. And I went to the piano. My dad started getting me piano lessons because he's like, I hear you trying to play. There's something missing. Let me get you piano lessons. Which turned into composition lessons with my teacher. There's so many little subplots here. And I went to the piano while they're trying to say, we got you doing coke at 7 a.m. You got a problem. I was like, that was sugar. It wasn't. You were right. It was coke. But I went to the piano and I was like, see, I have these two notes and I didn't know where to go. And then I smoked some weed and then I wrote this. And it was like 8 cool notes. It wasn't even a big deal. But to me, I was like, this is who I am. I smoke weed and I write music. And I'm like 16, probably sucking horribly and getting kicked out of schools. And I remember getting done and there was really no repercussion. Like I kind of said, this is how it's going and kind of dissolved.
Yeah.
But at that time, let me tell you, so my dad remarries and he has this, you know, hippie-ish chick. She's probably like 20 years his, you know, younger than he is. And that she never wears a bra. And so, you know, I was young enough but smart enough to know like, oh, all right, dad, you know, woohoo. Yeah. And she was a stoner. And every once in a while, the older brothers would hear, dad would say, you know, surely she needs marijuana. It's just the type of person she is. And so we're like, wow, dad's asking to get Shirley's stepmom weed. Okay, cool. So that was, I'm like, I'm smoking weed in the house. So we had a big long wall to my bedroom. And so I would sit in there smoking weed with my friends and my dad would knock all the way down the hall and then knock. Hold on, dad. Come on in. And then we'd be stoned out of our mind.
With your stepmom?
No, not with her. Sorry. But you know, this is what's going on. This is kind of setting the table. Like stepmom smoking her grass. We could smell it. And okay. I'm smoking it. So it's just this house of denial, right? We're not talking about anything. Dad obviously is giving me the opportunity to hide everything so he doesn't have to confront it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Meanwhile, through back channels of the family, the older kids are getting stepmom weed, but it's not out in the open, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Understandably so, but that's how it's going on.
Yeah.
So I get.
And this is all prior to it being legal.
This is prior to buds. She was smoking grass and we were like, why is she smoking grass? Because now we're starting to smoke weed and you could get buds, but it had to be outdoor and everything you got was like from indica or imported somewhere and snuck into the country. But she would say, I don't like those buds. I just want my grass. Like you're talking like, I don't know if you remember the t-shirts that used to say, how do you spell relief? Colombian. And it would be a picture of a pot leaf. Cause that's what people smoked is tobacco.
Right.
The leaf.
Yeah.
Way before all this hydroponic smoking endo. Sipping on gin and juices way before all that shit. Endo means, you know, yeah. So anyhow, we're kind of jumping all over you. Everybody at home who's listening is probably, I'm so confused. So I'm living with my dad and we're in Yorba Linda because I got kicked out of high school.
Oh, now you're in Yorba Linda.
Well, that's where I went when I got kicked out of school. I forgot to drop the city name.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm just following you around. I know. All over the place.
I kind of am. Sorry.
No. It's your story. Yeah, keeping track.
Well, because I'm trying to tie in other elements and stuff. So anyhow, you know, Quentin Tarantino would understand how I'm doing this. He would know that.
I understand. I just need clarification from doing that.
I'm just kidding. That's a horrible pulp fiction reference.
We're following.
Remember that movie where it was like all over and then it all comes together at the end?
Yeah.
So, when I got kicked out of high school for smoking weed, I moved in with my dad. I'm setting up the thing like he let me get away with anything. I'm still ditching school. And then now I'm doing tons of cocaine. They try to do a wimpy intervention. And then I turn 18 and I do whatever I want. And then dad's like, I just feel like every time I get the call that you're dead. And you got to go. So now I'm living in my car, working at Domino's Pizza, sleeping on couches, doing the couch tour. My friends are getting it so I could stay at their house for a couple nights, which now it's a week. And the parents are like, your friend's still here. Get rid of him. That was the chair.
Mel, we need new chairs.
There's actually a really funny, there's skits on that stuff everywhere. But anyhow, so he kicks me out. I'm living in my car. So my mom's working at an insurance company and she's like, come and I think I can get you a job here. She got me a job doing data entry and I kind of righted the ship. I quit smoking cigarettes. I quit smoking weed. I'm just kind of a weekend warrior drinking, but I'm still doing bands. Now I'm at the age where I'm actually in bands with singers and we play the whiskey. And back then,
oh wow,
that's huge.
Up in Hollywood. Yeah.
Well, but it isn't. I mean, any idiot, especially back then, could get on stage with it. And they had this thing called the No Bozos Jam on Mondays, where it's just like every band got like four songs and it would pack out. And back then it was so much easier to get people to go to shows and there's less fighting for people's attention. Mm-hmm. And the first my ripping bass player I alluded to earlier, he was a band slut. He would jump from band to band to band. That's what we called him back then.
The band slut.
Yeah, yeah. Guys that just don't stay loyal to any band. They're in this band, that band, that band.
Right.
And he's like, come play in this band. I was like, oh, that music sucks. But okay. He's like, we got a show at the Whiskey. And I was like, okay. So my first show at the Whiskey, I remember girls trying to pull me off the stage. And I was like, okay, I'm going to stay in this band because this is working for me. Because it got me out. And, you know, tying this back to anybody's story out there, sometimes you just have to do what gets you to the next level, even if you don't like it. And I think a lot of times in life, people don't do that. They're like, I don't like it. I'm not doing it. It's like, well, what do you got otherwise? Mm-hmm. You know, go get on that shitty team. Go start a shitty business. Put out a bad business plan. Just take action.
Yeah, do it. Do something. Yeah. Do something.
That got me on stage, learning somebody else's music, even though I didn't like it, but it gave me so much experience I needed. It made me such a better player. And so the point is now I'm working this corporate job, that mom got me. I'm starting to thrive a little bit wearing a tie and I'm a pretty smart guy and making good money. I start supervising the data entry team. Cause I came in with some ideas that kind of, they could tell I was a thinker. And what was happening was I was going for, you know, band after band. I was there for like 8 years. I remember cleaning out my desk once going and seeing all the different flyers of the bands and I'm going, am I just a loser that's never going to get anywhere? Like, look at all these shit bands I've had that haven't done anything. Well, then I met the singer who ended up being in my first band, Head PE. And I saw him and I was like, now this guy's got skills. I want to try to get him in a band. And anyhow, we started doing that. And this is how that came to be. We put this lineup together. We didn't know what direction. This is now late 80s, leading into early 90s. So what was the Hollywood scene, right, of the Motley Crues and, you know, Cinderella's and all these bands was just dead. It was like soulless anymore. It's just like the same old repeated stuff of glam. And then now 90s is coming in, right? And, you know, you got the Soundgardens and the Guns N' Roses and Nirvana's and all that. And we didn't know what direction. We got together, you know, we were both in bands with slapping bass players because that's how it was back then. Bam, 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 bam. And we're just like, oh, no more fucking slap. We got to get rid of that. But anyhow, so the singer and I went to a concert. Rage Against the Machine, Cypress Hill, and the Beastie Boys at San Dominguez Hills at the Velodrome or whatever that thing was called. And my stepbrother that I talked about, he was a big drug dealer. And we were going to that concert and I'm with my singer and we were writing all these bad songs in our new band and he gave us a bunch of mushrooms. It was like this much mushrooms. I remember I needed two hands to hold it and me and the singer, singer and I were like, should we eat before we do this? I'm like, nah, it might fuck up the high. Okay, we'll just take it. I just remember eating. The whole time my singer was like, we're this close to ODing. Well, I started ODing. I started nodding out of consciousness until I passed out. And then I just remember him above me. West. I was like, what? And he's like, I'm going to go get help. And I figured he's going to get my mom. I'm going to end up, he's going to get help. I'm going to go to the hospital. They're going to call my mom. So this cannot happen. I stayed there as long as I could on the ground, like with a sea of people. Like, I hope I don't get trampled on because this is a pretty intense concert. And then I trekked out to the back of the field and laid there for a while. But the point is, one, I pretty much OD'd on mushrooms, but two, we figured out what sound we wanted. We wanted to have that funky party like thing the BC Boys had, you know, and I decided I want a DJ, but I want to put a DJ in a rock band. At the time, Biscuit wasn't a band. Deftones didn't have a DJ. Incubus didn't have a DJ. All these bands, we didn't even know them yet. It was a very original idea. I proudly say I'm probably the first guy to put a DJ in a rock band that I know of. Huh. And I've yet to find anybody who can disprove that. Anyhow, not important. We figured out our sound there. And from that place, you know, we knew we wanted to have that dark gangster stuff. We felt hip hop didn't really go over well live, but rock bands can usually get stuff into the audience a little better. And then what was it? So BC Boys, Cypress Hill, and then Rage Against the Machine. Like those guys just riff the whole crowd. It's just like,
Yeah. They
just get the people moving. And so we realized our sound there. And then fast forward, we started playing some local clubs, and that's when we met the Korn guys. And then we stole a little bit of their sound, but hopefully not too much. And then, so what happened was, to tie in my drug use, at that point I was just doing some mushrooms, but mainly just weed, drinking, you know, weekend warrior, pitchers of beer, tequila. Well, I came home and I had to go to rehearsal one night. On a Sunday, I think it was. And I had been day drinking because I have a drinking problem, but I don't know it. Not in the alcoholic sense, but like, you know, I can't control it. I've now got to go to rehearsal and I'm way too drunk. I walk in on my roommate, which means the guy sleeping on my couch, and my girlfriend, which means the girl that likes me that not leave. And I don't mean to throw shade, but we're not in love, but we're living together. What the fuck are we doing? We're just being stupid kids. Pardon my F-bombs.
Yeah. All good.
Tell your story.
Yeah. Right? They say people who cuss, you can trust them because they're more authentic. Yep. So I say that is fucking true. just kidding. I don't want to be too gratuitous. So anyhow, I walk in too drunk. Keep in mind, this is a hint of the beginning of the powerlessness. Because I have to go to rehearsal, and if this is my big dream, you think I don't get too drunk before rehearsal, but of course I did. And I walk in, and they come up like they were just doing a line, and I was like, what is that? And I go, I want some. And they go, well, it's heroin. I go, okay, I'll try some of that. And what happened is I did this line, and then I'm like, I'm too drunk, told my roommate guy, couch server guy, can you drive me to rehearsal? And he goes, yeah, I'll totally love to come with you. And so I'm in the car and I'm twanging the guitar in the front seat, my acoustic. And like, I wrote a really, what I felt like was a cool song. And then I wrote another song. I was like, I just wrote two songs on the way to rehearsal. And I was trying to go, hey man, this heroin, I thought it was supposed to make you mellow, you know? And I feel freaking awesome right now. And he goes, you idiot. That was meth. Well, I was sold. Oh. I was sold. I was like, this is great. So now I'm my day job wearing my tie supervising. But when Friday came, I could not wait to go to my friend's house. She always had the meth, and we would just art out all night, draw pictures and photos and camcorder and play guitar. And that's what happened. And meanwhile, my band's now starting to do really well. We know what sound we want. I've now found my muse in the drugs. I'm staying up all night. I'm now like just as an artist, just coming out, you know what I mean? Just on the edge of creating. And I think it's like just uninhibited, you know? And next thing you know, we're selling out clubs and record labels are flying in from New York and all over to see us. And I remember, and I'm on tweak all day, every day at this point. I got fired from my job. I'll skip over the long version of that story, but I wanted to get fired and I got fired.
The job is a data input?
Yeah.
Because that's a kind of a contrast, data entry with a suit and tie and playing rock at the whiskey.
I had worked myself into like a management position so I could like, okay, so check this out. We're at that point, we're rehearsing nonstop. My day, and this is good for people to hear about the hustle. I was working 8 and 10 hours a day there, and it was off 17th Street in the 55, kind of Santa Ana-ish. And I would drive home to Huntington Beach, and then go into Huntington Harbor, pick up my singer, and drive to where the Citadel is off the 710 and the 5, like that Firestone building. We would rehearse. We would rehearse in this building. It was called Vernon. It was like an old meatpacking place. It was basically four stories, bricks only, no windows, nothing. So it'd be literally 120 in there in the summer. And bands like Korn and Cold Chamber and all these bands would rehearse in there. But I would drive, you know, after work, all these hours, get the guys, go rehearse for a number of hours with no AC. Then we would go out to the clubs and the parties and pass out flyers every night. So when I would go to my data entry job, I had a little cubicle. I had it set up so I could face the wall and all my staff was over here. So I would put a pen in my hand. And then I just sleep. And if somebody came up and be like, oh yeah, what's up? What's going on? Because I couldn't not sleep. I mean, yeah. I'm talking 1 and 2 hours of sleep a night.
Ooh.
And I was just, you know, getting by. So eventually they're like, you know, yeah, Wes, you're missing too much work. What's up? You got to change. I'm like, look, I'm going to get a record deal. I'm not changing. You have a choice. I'm going to keep going like this or you can fire me. They're like, we like you. You're like betraying the company. I'm like, I know it sucks, doesn't it? But I want unemployment. And they're like, fine, we're firing you out of here. I'm like, yeah. So yeah, we're selling out clubs, and you know, we worked our ass off to push our popularity. And I remember one time driving to a club where we're like, shit, we didn't really pass out that many flyers for this show. Hope people will be there. So we came around the corner. We just saw a line down the street, and you know, we knew we were onto something.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask Wes a question about if maybe all this self-medication, we'll call it, is really kind of covering some stuff up. But we'll do that as soon as we come back.
Perfect. Good.
All right.
Yes. Rockstar.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.